After all, I didn't go to military police school, for heaven's sake, I went to cook school. As far as I was concerned, these three guys could easily have slit my throat, taken the jeep and hightailed it in a panicky, desperate bid to escape their fate. Yet Paul had never mentioned that event during our discussions about the times he had come to me during perilous moments. Again, this gives me pause. Suppose he isn't a spiritual entity who has been with me for a lifetime? Maybe he is a mere mortal, albeit a very advanced one, who has the ability to tap into my thoughts. But if the memory of that very serious and potentially hazardous situation wasn't in my thoughts and only now has resurfaced, then he wouldn't have been aware of it. Thus he wouldn't have mentioned it. And he never did. There are still many questions. In the meantime, I wait. Observation by Paul: too many people spend too much time trying to settle old scores when they should be concentrating on the game coming up. Occasional visitor: I haven't had any further trouble with the cops. But when I'm out running errands in my pickup, it's nice to know that Paul is in the passenger seat, or at least I presume he is. I don't see him often anymore. Marco and I make contact every now and then. I continue to practice, to try to develop my telepathic skills, but not with the same intensity or fervor as before. I have made some further rudimentary contacts with other telepaths, but nothing so dramatic as to convince me that I am making breakthrough progress. Frankly, I am fairly certain that I am never going to advance much beyond the point where I currently am. However, I'm not terribly disappointed. It's still fun and exciting whenever I do pick up a signal or get acknowledgement that someone else has received a communication from me. Hearing from a totally new person is particularly stimulating. That usually happens on a random basis, but I have reason to believe that there is a whole network of journeyman telepaths around the world who are constantly in contact with one another. Their numbers run into the thousands, I have heard. At least that is what is rumored among those of us who have rudimentary abilities but who are not proficient enough to become part of the network. It is said that an expert can join the dialogue on the network as easily as logging onto an internet chat room and joining the conversation. I often find myself daydreaming about how marvelous it would be to have the skills to join such a group. But even if I never advance to that level, I am grateful for the rudimentary skills that I have been given and for the experiences that they have afforded me. Mel has sent word that Eddie Dwyer's mutt was run over and killed by a car. The big man apparently was relating the news to Mel in a bar when he lost his composure and started blubbering like a little girl. He just buried his head in his arms on the bar and sobbed his heart out, Mel said. He changed after the fight. He grew real quiet. He doesn't seem to have a chip on his shoulder anymore, and we've had some real nice conversations at the bar. He's really not such a bad guy. He invited me and my wife over to his place for a barbecue. We're going to go. Anyway, when he started crying for his dog, I just felt so bad for him. He's such a big guy. I never saw a big guy cry before. I thought I was going to start bawling myself. My throat got all tight and I really choked up. I put my arm on his shoulder in sympathy, and the next thing I know I'm holding him in a hug while he's crying. I reached for the Kleenex as I read Mel's note. I should have listened to Paul, but I had been too pig-headed. What had I proved? That I was now a better man than Eddie? That was obviously not true. A heavy blanket of remorse settled upon me as I came to realize that I had simply traded places with him. I had become the bully whom I once despised. I felt like a wretch, and at that moment I finally understood why Paul had been so opposed to my course of action. I dabbed at my eyes with the Kleenex and with a mixture of guilt and contrition vowed silently to put more trust in Paul's advice. However, Paul has made himself pretty scarce lately. It's not as though anything has come between us or that we aren't on speaking terms. He just believes that I have gotten through the crisis that he insists I was facing and that it is time for him to melt into the background and out of sight. I still disagree with his contention that I was in dire need of his intervention in the form of talk therapy, but I certainly have no regrets whatsoever that he acted upon that belief. He still hasn't divulged what important work awaits me, and I don't bother asking or even thinking much about it anymore. Whatever it is, I'm sure I'll understand at the appropriate time. For that matter, I don't even know when or if I will ever see him again, although every once in a while he makes his presence known to me audibly, visibly, or sometimes just as a subtle but very real feeling detected by a sixth sense. I suspect he'll stay in touch. If not, just the knowledge of his existence has made a profound change in my life, and I know he will continue to be there until I take my last breath. After that, I'm not certain of anything. Observation by Paul: a guardian angel is not a nursemaid. I help at times, but you are ultimately responsible for your own destiny. Apostrophe, epilogue. I began compiling notes actually. Keeping a diary is more accurate shortly after Paul showed up in my gazebo in November of 2001, and I continued doing so until the adventure just fizzled out in early 2003. In April of that year, I began to periodically work on the notes to try to organize them into some kind of coherent story. As the months rolled by, a manuscript of sorts began to take shape. After a year or two, I considered the project finished and I put it aside. For some reason that eludes me, I didn't make any attempt to market the manuscript, and it reposed dormant in my computer until sometime early in 2006, if memory serves. Perhaps I considered it to be just what it began as, a private diary for my eyes only, or that the information was somehow privileged, too personal to share. Then again, maybe I thought the manuscript wasn't marketable, that there wouldn't be much interest in it. Whatever the reason, the fact remains that I simply set it aside. But then an occasion arose where I happened to show it to the CEO of Origin Press, which had published my second book in 2001. He expressed an interest in it, but I was still reluctant. Over a period of months, perhaps a year, in a number of phone conversations and emails, he invariably inquired whether I had changed my mind. I hadn't. However, in April of 2006 I did have a change of heart and agreed to submit it for publication. For reasons peculiar to the publishing business which I know nothing about, the project got off to a fitful start, and it was on again slash off again for more than a year. During those fits and starts, I worked on polishing the manuscript during the on again times, put it aside during the off again times, and repeated the process several times. Finally, sometime in the fall I got the final go-ahead, with a January deadline and a planned publication date for June of 2008. For several months I rewrote and polished, shipping the pages off to the publisher as they became available for editing, which he then sent back to me with corrections, suggestions, and revisions to be incorporated into the manuscript. At last, the day arrived when I deemed the manuscript to be complete, ready for one final look by the publisher before going off to the printer. Only moments after I hit the send key Monday, February 11th, several weeks behind schedule launching the final draft into cyberspace, destination Origin Press, I nearly leapt out of my skin. Paul and I hadn't visited much for years, and it had been well over a year, probably more, since our last contact. When we had been meeting on a regular basis, I had become accustomed to his abrupt comings and goings. However, the recent hiatus apparently had lulled me into a less anticipatory state, to a certain degree, in which I wasn't very primed for his sudden appearances. That's probably the reason that I recoiled when a soft voice, spoken directly into my ear, sent my spine a-quivering. "So you're actually going ahead with this, are you?" he asked. He was standing directly behind me, bent over my shoulder peering at the computer screen. "Jeepers, I really wish you would give me some advance notice before you do that," I said after my heart had settled back to a rate comparable to that of a nervous rabbit. It was not surprising to me, of course, that Paul would know about the manuscript and my plans for it. Most likely he had been the reading over my shoulder all the time that I was putting it together. As such, I wasn't sure if his question was mere rhetoric or if really was seeking information. I leaned toward the rhetorical explanation on the assumption that there wasn't much about me that he didn't know. I swiveled around in my chair in front of the table that holds my computer equipment and planted my feet on one of two medical office stools that I keep in the room. Paul settled down on the other one by my desk. I leaned back and cupped my hands behind my head, hoping to assume a casual demeanor to disguise the defensiveness that I was feeling. I had made commitments regarding the manuscript, after several years of hesitancy, and I had the feeling that Paul was going to argue against the project. Otherwise, why would he be showing up now right when I was on the cusp of finalizing it, particularly since I hadn't seen much of him in several years? "Yeah, I think it's an interesting story," I said, and I finally decided, after much contemplation, that I'd like to share it. I was going to ask him if he had any objections, but then thought better of it. So I fiddled with a ballpoint pen instead, hoping that my laid-back masquerade was working. I wasn't sure how I'd react if I'd express misgivings, but I didn't want to give him an opening. If he had something to say that I didn't want to hear, let him do it without my help. "You've thought it through as best you can, I presume," he said. "But I don't know if you've considered all of the implications." "I think I have." "Why, what do you have in mind?" "Damn." So much for my resolve not to give him an opening. I had just done it. "First, there's the dialogue. Don't you think readers are going to doubt that you have the ability to remember with such accuracy the actual words that were spoken by me and others over a period of several years? You didn't take notes and you didn't record the conversations. When you put quotation marks around words, it indicates that those are the exact words that were spoken. I would say there's a high degree of inaccuracy there." "I presume you've read the manuscript," I said.
"I have."
"Can you point out one instance where the quoted material does not accurately and honestly capture the thoughts, the tenor, and the nuances of the speaker's words without any bias or distortion?" "That's not the point. What you probably don't know, because I haven't written it yet, is that the book will contain an explanation of the very thing. The quoted material is an approximation of what was said, and the reader will understand that." "That's good, being open about it. Now, another thing I'm curious about, what was the deciding factor for your ultimate decision? I know you weren't too keen on the idea for a long time. Why the change of heart?" "It was a tough question, and I'm not sure I could provide a satisfactory answer. Certainly it wasn't the money. I don't accept royalties from my publisher. I encourage him to sink any such funds back into the business so that he can continue to bring out important books. It certainly wasn't for any small bit of fleeting fame that might come my way. I value my privacy and I don't particularly care for the attention that the books draw to me." The brooding look now wrinkling my brow didn't do much to reinforce the breezy attitude I was trying to maintain. Surely it couldn't have escaped Paul's notice. "I suppose if I had some time, maybe a week, to think about it, I could have come up with a fairly reasonable answer to his question. But at the moment, it totally eluded me. I could only guess. Dunno. Maybe I just couldn't resist the charisma and persuasiveness of my publisher," I said with a sheepish smile.
"Ah," Paul said, with almost a snort.
"Well, be that as it may, let me ask you this, what good is it going to do you?" I pulled my feet off the stool and turned to stare at Paul directly in the eyes. "Before I answer that, why the third degree? Why are you so interested in my motives? Do you have any reservations about the project? Are you trying to talk me out of going ahead with it?" I asked resolutely. I already had given him the opening that I vowed to myself that I wouldn't, so I didn't see any point in trying to continue the charade at this point. Frankly, I was becoming a little annoyed, perhaps because I felt that he was prodding me, putting me on the defensive. I was of a mind that I didn't need to justify my decision to anyone, including Paul. "Believe it or not, I'm only thinking of your best interests," he responded quietly. "No, I have no objections to the book if that's what you really want. I'm just concerned that you may be placing yourself in a position that could subject you to a lot of stress. I simply don't want you to fall into that same situation I found you in back then, you know." He gave me a quizzical look and a nod, as if to ask if I understood. I did. I could see that we were back at that old disagreement again, the one where he feared that I might be suicidal despite my steadfast insistence that he was far off the mark. I will admit that I had been feeling pretty crummy back then. What was it,
over 6 years ago compared to how terrific I was feeling these days. Maybe the talk therapy, my meetings with Paul over a period of about 18 months, had something to do with the transformation. Or maybe it was just the good old passage of time which I understand heals all. "Have no fear," I said, "I'm fine and I intend to remain so." "What do you think reader reaction will be to your book?" "Mixed, as usual. But I have a feeling that you're talking about the ones who will think I'm loco, and whether that's going to put me in a funk again and require another intervention by you." "Very perceptive. And also inadvertently revealing. You practically admitted that my intervention was required. You didn't say elicit or trigger an intervention, you said require. That undercuts your previous protests and denials about the need for me to step in when I did." He was right, of course. Call it a Freudian slip, or whatever. But I now believe that my psyche had spoken. Had I really been feeling so rotten that I did need no, require Paul's help to deal with my emotional turmoil? Had I been kidding myself all along? I took a moment to truly examine my innermost thoughts and feelings, the ones around which I had posted an almost impenetrable defense of bravado and machismo. I lowered the guard and took an honest look, and was mildly shaken by the view. He had been on the mark all along. I actually had needed him at the time he made his initial appearance in the gazebo, and I was now willing to admit it to myself. Nevertheless, that was then, and this was now. The circumstances were quite different. He was comparing apples and oranges. Previously, I had been reeling from the 9/11 attacks, which had dealt a severe emotional blow to the whole nation while causing the termination of a crucial project of mine, and I certainly wasn't immune from being traumatized. What we were dealing with now, however, or at least what Paul seemed to be focused upon, was how the reaction to the book from a certain element of critics would affect my outlook. "Hey, just Google me and you'll discover that a lot of people are saying a lot of things about me, as you probably already know." I thought he was enormously overestimating my fragility. I'm not a porcelain doll. If I were 25 and looking to impress the girls, trying to find a good job, building a career, I probably would have had some interest in what others thought or said about me. But I already have a girl, am retired from a nifty job and career, and I'm 73 years old. Many things that seem so earth-shakingly important when we are young tend to fade into insignificance when we reach the autumn of our years. "Say, is this another talk therapy session?" I asked after the notion suddenly popped into my mind. Paul flashed a smile and a look of amusement. "Not really. I can become just as curious as the next person." "Don't be so defensive," he said cheerily, "this is just a friendly visit. However, if you have anything to get off your chest, I'm willing to discuss it with you. As I said, I'm fine. Unless you think I'm wacko for sitting here talking with some imaginary entity." I had to grin at that one. Paul let loose with a hearty laugh, perhaps sharing the ludicrous and hilarious scene that the statement conjured up, at least in my mind's eye. "I mean, here's the joke: a guy is talking to an imaginary friend, and the friend says, 'You are nuts, you know.' And the guy asks his friend why he would say that. The friend replies, 'Because you're talking to me, and even I'm sane enough to know that I don't exist.'" It tickled my funny bone. "Maybe you had to be there." "Yeah, you'll probably be okay," Paul said. "You're obviously in good spirits at the moment, and I think the vicissitudes of life aren't going to be as threatening as they once were. I suppose you can give some credit to the seasoning that comes with age. Well, you have things to do, so I'll let you be." With that, he stood and it seemed evident that he was on the verge of taking his leave. I was disappointed. I was reminded of how much I had always enjoyed our time together, and I didn't want him to leave just yet. I grappled for some words to delay his departure. "You know, I'm not sure I believe that everyone has a guardian angel." Apostrophe the words were out of my mouth while my brain was still trying to think of something to say. I didn't even know at the moment if I believed that, or even where the comment came from. All I know is that it got Paul's immediate attention. He sat down again, an inquiring look on his face. "If you meant to be provocative, you've certainly succeeded," he said. "Okay, something's on your mind, So let's talk about it. Crikey, now I felt like a condemned man who had just been strapped into the electric chair and asked if I had any last words. I mean, such an occasion seemed to call for something more than just idle chatter from the condemned about what a cozy place the warden had there. If I knew why I had blurted out my doubts about guardian angels, conceivably I could follow up with a hello of some sort, or at least something credible to justify the remark. I squirmed and stammered momentarily, and suddenly the germ that had triggered the statement came rising out of the depths of my memory like an express elevator. I put my feet back up on the stool and assumed a more relaxed, but assertive, attitude. Let me ask you this. You had implied that somehow my application for a job at the Times happened to be sitting on the top of the pile just at the very moment that the copy desk supervisor needed to hire another editor. That's not the question, right? He asked drolly. The comment brought a smile from me and a reminder of the teasing, the interplay of words and wit that invariably became a component of our conversations, even despite the seriousness of them at times. My impulsive comment as he was preparing to leave despite any deeper meaning certainly gave the effect of keeping him around. That pleased me. Seriously, I said, wasn't someone deprived of a job because it went to me, possibly because of your intervention? Maybe you and the other person's angel clashed, and you won, which was a win for me and a loss for the other guy. Or is it just simply that not everybody has a guardian? Maybe just some us lucky ones do? Paul leaned backward on the stool, his elbows and forearms tucked back onto the desk as he faced me. I see your point. Yes, it would be unseemly for two angels to get into a turf battle. So you think someone got a raw deal because you have a guardian and the other person doesn't, is that it? Well, it does beg the question of what happens when two or more angels have incompatible interests. How do they reconcile their differences? You're assuming there were winners and losers. Who were they? I won and everybody else lost, I said. Really? Your supervisor also won, he got the editor he was seeking. The job had opened suddenly and he needed to fill it quickly. You lived nearby and were available immediately. Those were two key requirements, which automatically eliminated the bulk of applicants. Incidentally, that would have included you if you were from out of town. Your deskmates won because you were able to carry your share of the workload. More of that burden would have shifted to them if a less qualified person had been hired. Maybe they and the supervisor thanked their angels for that little blessing. I'm sure the supervisor also got credit for saving their newspaper time and money because the Times didn't have to pay for transportation, lodging and meals for a string of TOEIC tryouts from out of town. I'm not saying that I wished someone else had gotten the job, I said. It's just that it seems to me that guardian angels would have to lock horns in certain situations. If that is inconceivable, then an alternative would be that some people don't have angels looking after them. Wrong on both counts. We don't do battle lock horns, as you put it. Sometimes we confer. No one got the jobs for you, you got it yourself. Besides, life is full of disappointments, guardian angels or not. I was starting to regret even beginning this conversation. It wasn't going anywhere that I had any real interest in visiting. The brutal and selfish fact of life is, I didn't care if I had started with an unfair advantage going into the competition. I was just glad that I had gotten the job instead of someone else. It had altered the course of my life, and I was happy with the outcome. I now wanted to wrap up the conversation. But Paul still had a few more things to say. And there weren't any losers, Paul said. Those who weren't offered a tryout lost nothing. They simply went on with their lives, oblivious to the processes that went on at the Times. Do you see my point? Call me obtuse, but, no, I didn't. However, I respect Paul, so I give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that his line of reasoning is impeccable and that his conclusion is a valid one. The conversation essentially ended on that note. I wish I could say that he left me with a lot to think about, but only two things came to mind. Angels don't do battle, they confer. To me that means, diplomacy over war under all circumstances. And the second thing? I've been very lucky. Postscript, an update on the contact project. Although this chronicle is meant to stand alone and distinct from the author's two previous books, The Contact has begun in The Challenge of Contact, there is nevertheless a tangential link between them. With that in mind, this seems the right place and the appropriate time to present a brief update for the benefit of previous readers on what has been called the Contact Project. Many of them have raised questions and expressed keen interest in finding out what, if any, events or communications may have transpired in the long interim since the author's last book in 2001. You'll recall that hundreds of humans from all races and nationalities of humankind were secretly contacted by the Verdants, a very advanced ET race, as part of the Contact Project. These contactees were known either as ambassadors or deputy envoys. As far as can be determined, 100% of the ambassadors and deputy envoys have remained publicly unidentified, although about a dozen or so people have approached the author claiming ambassadorial status. Most of them could not support their claims during routine questioning and/or vetting of their credentials. However, at least two have established themselves as completely authentic. One of them personally delivered a momentous message to the author in March of 2001 at a major UFO conference in Laughlin, Nevada. This message indicated that, after lengthy discussions between the ambassadors and the Verdants, a date for the contact had finally been set and that he, the author, would have the honor of announcing it. The publicly available record shows that on August 25, 2001, my publisher pre-announced my keynote speech at the UFO Expo, which was to occur on September 16, 2001, during which I was to announce the good news. As is well known to those who have followed the author's story, on the evening of 9/11 the ETs abruptly suspended the formal contact between themselves and the human species. Crisis conditions on Earth required that the Contact Project be put on indefinite hold. Readers of The Challenge of Contact will recall that the author reported on this entire drama in that volume. Since those days, there have been no more face-to-face or telepathic contacts between the author and the Verdants. But one major development is pending that readers of the Contact books have a right to know about. A second claimant who passed muster first contacted the author in April of 2006. He was an intriguing fellow who held prominent social and business positions and whose credibility turned out to be impeccable. The author, who approached all such correspondents cautiously and skeptically, began a two-week period of communication with him by email and telephone. Eventually they met face to face and the author was soon won over. A mutually trusting relationship developed between the two. There was no doubt that the man was legitimate. He was an authentic ambassador who had undeniably been a guest of the Verdants aboard the Goodwill, the mother ship stationed in the vicinity of the Earth. The man, whom the author refers to by the pseudonym Louis Winslow, was an integral figure in the Verdants' plans for contact, designated to play a major role. Of course, this was a secret part of his life that he had shared with no one. After the postponement, Louis had some blunt discussions with the Verdants about the possibilities for an early resumption of the contact plans. Although the Verdants could not provide any specific timetable, they did provide him with a realistic assessment of the current human condition and the effects it was having on their mission. Louis admitted to the author during one of their face-to-face sessions that he came away from the discussions with the Verdants in a deep funk. He was despondent and felt like someone who had suffered a terrible psychological whipping. In addition, he was convinced that humanity was doomed, that the world would not recover from its madness, and that the Verdants would ultimately give up on the human race. After all, it was no secret among the ambassadors that the Verdants had indicated having seen such meltdowns before in other civilizations. In essence, Louis explained that he had been in a state of grief. Not only was he fearful for the future of the human race, but on a more personal and selfish level he was mourning his own lost opportunity. The chance to play a key role in the most significant moment in human history. His personal life also had been a mess, he admitted. And even if contact plans were renewed in his lifetime, it would be necessary to recruit almost a whole new slate of ambassadors because many original ones would have died while others would be too aged to take on the burden required, he said. Hopeless, alone, unhappy, and dispirited, He accepted an offer by the Verdants to participate in a sabbatical, an offer tendered because of the high esteem and regard in which the Verdants held him.